Thank you, David. Well, it's a great pleasure to speak at this seminar. And I like the idea of lunch seminar because, you know, even if you don't like the seminar, at least you enjoy your lunch. So, and everything smells good, so bon appétit, and you know, I hope I don't distract you too much from eating. But I represent here a program on non-perturbative effects and dualities in quantum field theory and integral systems. And I am a mathematician. My name is Edward. Hi, my name is Edward, and I'm a recovering mathematician. So, so what I'd like to talk about today is, you know, our program is really a synthesis of math and physics and the interplay between the two, and I want to talk about some of the aspects of both and how they interact with each other. So since I am a mathematician, I will start with some mathematics. I will start with some 17th century mathematics, 1637 to be precise. French mathematician Pierre Fermat. Left a note on a book, on a very good book at that. It was a Diophantus Arithmetica from the 3rd century, I suppose, which gave a start to all what they call now Diophantine equations. So he left a note on the margin of that book saying that he found a remarkable proof of a remarkable fact that the equation x to the n plus y to the n equals z to the n has no integer solutions x, y, z, provided that n is greater than infinity. Unfortunately, he wrote, this margin is too narrow to contain this remarkable proof. So this is what I think of as a 17th century equivalent of a Twitter proof. You know, so you tweet, I found the remarkable proof of this fact. It's too bad that Twitter only allows me 140 characters. But, you know, this was a great idea because, of course, the people took this as a challenge, so that Fermat found this beautiful proof, so we should also go out and try to replicate it. And the search was on for more than 350 years until this result was finally proved. The challenge was settled by Andrew Wiles and Richard Taylor in 1994. So That's the first bit. And next, I want to talk about something that about 19th century physics. So 1861 or 62, James Clerk Maxwell writes his equations for electromagnetism. And these are beautiful differential equations describing electric and magnetic fields, usually denoted as E and B. And then you look at these equations, and one of the things you quickly realize are very symmetrical. So in fact, there's a beautiful symmetry of these equations, which is essentially interchanges the two fields, the electric and magnetic fields. E goes to B and B goes to negative E. The equations remain the same. So electromagnetic duality. So the question I want to pose, which was the title of this talk, is what do these two results, these two phenomena have in common? And the answer is given in terms of 21st century mathematics and physics. Mathematical physics, exactly the kind of mathematical physics that we're exploring here at this program at KITP. And it roughly goes like this. So on the physics side, you have this electromagnetic duality. Here I talk about this electromagnetic duality for classical field theory, classical electromagnetism described by Maxwell equations. There is also quantum theory of electromagnetism, which is an example of what we know as a Young-Mills theory, as a gauge theory. And electromagnetism is a gauge theory with the simplest gauge group, which is a circle, or U1, the abelian the simplest abelian compact Lie group. We also know that there are important gauge theories which have non-abelian gauge groups. Non-abelian gauge groups. So for example, the standard model. In the standard model, this non-abelian gauge theory plays a very important role. So the question was posed in the 70s as to whether electromagnetic duality traced to the quantum level also has an analog for non-abelian gauge theories. And an answer was proposed, which is now known as S-duality. Namely, it was suggested that gauge theories with non-abelian gauge groups have a very mysterious equivalence which generalizes the electromagnetic duality. So that's around 1970. So a remarkable aspect of this S-duality was that the gauge group under this duality, the gauge group, gets replaced by another group, which is called a dual group. And so there was always this big question as to why this happens and what the meaning of the dual group is in the physics context. On the other hand, in parallel, here we start with Fermat's last theorem. And of course, what Wiles and Taylor proved was not exactly the Fermat's last theorem. It was a different result, which was earlier shown to imply Fermat's last theorem. And that result is known as the Taniyama-Shimura Wey conjecture, now theorem, also known as the modularity theorem. This connection, this link, was made by Fry and Ribbett in the 80s. The Taniyama-Shimura Wey conjecture itself can be viewed as a very special case of what's called the Langlands program. Special case of the Langlands program. And the Langlands program, in turn, can be formulated in the realm of geometry. So maybe I'll call it the geometric Langlands program. And this, there's a lot of work in this direction in the 90s. Last 10 years. And so the crucial link finally came about 5 years ago, which was the connection between S-duality and the appearance of the dual group here and the geometric Langlands program in which the Langlands dual group also appears. So this is a work which started with the work of the physicist Kapustin-Witten. And has been continued by many others, and has already led to a lot of interesting insights into both physics and mathematics, and in particular led to our workshops here at KITP starting in 2008. So that's the brief outline. That's what electromagnetic duality and Fermat's last theorem have in common. They have in common the fact that they both can be viewed as part of the Langlands duality or the Langlands program. So now I would like to talk a little bit more about this. And also to talk about what physics brings into this picture, the insights that physics brings into this picture, and how it helps us to unravel some of the closely related mathematics, which perhaps eventually in the future will help us to prove many more results like this without giving any excuses that the margin or the blackboard is too small to contain it. So, first of all, I want to tell you a little bit about this Langlands program. Langlands is a mathematician at the Institute for Advanced Study. And perhaps an interesting aspect is that he occupies the office, which was formerly occupied by Albert Einstein at the Institute. So also kind of a crossing between physics and math, if you think about it. So now, how does the Fermat's last theorem fit this broad and general Langlands program? I want to talk about this Tanyama-Shimura Bay conjecture, which really is what implies Fermat's last theorem. And Tanyama-Shimura Bay conjecture is about the study of elliptic curves. Tanyama-Shimura Bay conjecture is about the study of elliptic curves. An elliptic curve, of course, over the complex field is something that we can draw very easily. It's simply torus. From the point of view of algebraic geometry, we can describe such a curve by an equation. So we'll write something like this: y squared equals x cubed plus ax plus b. And if you are a and b are complex numbers, and you look for solutions, so these are fixed, and x and y are the two variables, so you look at solutions, x and y, then you will get precisely a Riemann surface like this, if you saved for the point at infinity. But when you study number theory, it is also interesting to look at solutions of such equations, which are the integer solutions. So let's assume that they're fixed and they're integers. And so then we look at the set of solutions of this equation, which are also integral solutions. But we can relax the condition a little bit and look at solutions modulo some prime number, mod p, where p is a prime. So in other words, we just look at the numbers, at the integers x and y, which solve this equation, but so that the left and right hand side differ by multiple of a given prime. So for each prime, we'll then get a certain number of solutions. And plus, we'll add the point at infinity, infinite point. So this will be this set of solutions you can think of as a kind of a shadow of the same elliptic curve, which we can visualize so nicely over the complex numbers. But this will be a shadow of that elliptic curve, which we look at now in the arithmetic modulo P. So these numbers are very important because they carry a lot of interesting number theoretic information. And the question is, what are these numbers? And is there some underlying general principle which allows us to express all of them at once? Is there a nice generating function, for example, which will carry all of these numbers all at once? And that's the statement of the Tanyama-Shimura-Weil conjecture. Tanyama-Shimura-Weil conjecture relates these numbers to objects of a totally different nature, which live in the world of analysis, namely to modular forms on upper half plane. So now we enter the world of analysis, or harmonic analysis, to be a little more precise. So we have the upper half plane, all complex numbers such that the imaginary part is greater than zero. We'll have an action on this upper half plane of the group SL to Z of 2 by 2 matrices, determinant 1, and the action is simply that tau goes to A tau plus B divided by C tau plus D. In particular, one of these special cases of such a transformation is the transformation tau goes to negative 1 over tau, for example. And so there is these objects which are called modular forms. They are essentially functions on the upper half plane, which have favorable transformation properties under the action of this group, which is essentially invariant under the action of this group, maybe invariant up to multiplying by some simple factor. So the statement of the Tanyama-Shimura conjecture is that to each elliptic curve like this, which I'll call E, you can naturally associate a modular form, FE. And we can write this modular form in a Fourier series, and the natural parameter for the Fourier series would be q, which is e to the 2 pi I tau. So we can write this as a sum of bn q to the n, n to 1. And it will be, in fact, what's called a cusp form. So the constant coefficient will vanish. There will be no b0, it will start with b1. And the constant coefficient at tau equal plus pi infinity. And which is where we're doing the expansion now. And we'll normalize it so that b1 is equal to 1. So now it's normalized. And so the statement is that this Fe is going to have a very nice property with respect to the action of this modular group. In fact, it will be what's called a modular form of weight 2. Of weight 2 with respect to a certain congruent subgroup. In other words, it will have favorable properties, not with respect to all transformations, but a certain subgroup thereof. But this is a technical detail. The most important fact is that this is, there's this analytic object, which is essentially, think of it as a generating function of some numbers, of some integers. And the remarkable fact is that those numbers AP, the numbers of solutions of this Diophantian equation, this equation mod P, cannot actually all be found, all save for finitely many of those which divide the discriminant of this, of the right-hand side. All of them, except perhaps for finitely many, can be found as a coefficient of this modular form. So I want you to appreciate the magnitude of this statement. I mean, on the objects of totally different nature. Here we have number theory. Here we study some equations and integers. Here we study analysis and we look at some analytic functions which have some very peculiar properties. And it turns out that all of these numbers which appear at first glance as totally transcendental. So to be absolutely precise, I should write p plus 1 minus ap, the number of solutions to have this equality. Totally transcendental in nature. If you try to do on the computer to calculate these numbers, you will see that they behave in a very strange way. And yet all of them turn out to be coefficients of one and the same analytic function. So that's a remarkable conjecture to make. How does one even come up with this stuff? Right. So, and that result, that conjecture, implies Fermat's theorem, because an elliptic curve which has this property is called modular, and the conjecture is that all elliptic curves are modular. That's the statement of the Taniyama-Shimura-Wei conjecture. So the idea of Fry, which was then later confirmed by Fibet in the 80s, was that if you have a solution of Fermat's equation, we want to prove that there are no integer solutions of Fermat's equation. If there were a solution, it would give us an elliptic curve which would not have this property, for which we wouldn't be able to find such a modular form. So if we knew the statement of the Taniyama-Shimura-Wei conjecture, we then obtained Fermat's last theorem. And Wiles and Taylor have in fact proved Taniyama-Shimura-Wei conjecture for so-called semi-stable elliptic curves, which was enough for these purposes, and that was eventually generalized to all elliptic curves.
What's the meaning of other coefficients of this form?
So they have multiplicative properties. So you have b of m times n, where m and n are relatively prime. It's equal to the product of the two. So these coefficients corresponding to the primes, in fact, determine the whole thing. Yeah. So and now. So what kind of statement is the Taniyama-Shimura-Wei conjecture? Well, that can be put in a very broad context of the Langlands program. And
Could you explain more why this?
How does it link?
If you understand, why can't you have a modular form?
It's not in one line explanation, but yeah. So if there is a solution, then it would imply that the corresponding elliptic, then you construct, you write down explicitly what a certain a and b, which are obtained from the solution of the Fermat, of a would-be solution of the Fermat equation, and then you look at this elliptic curve and you see that it's not modular, which we now know is impossible. That's why the solution didn't exist in the first place. Yes?
But so the a, b there is not, in particular, the AB of the
prime. No, yeah, that's right. So that was
now,
not a good.
The reason I ask is how am I, but I suppose that equivalence to me right now seems almost, I'm not sure, you know, if you told me go to a computer or start computing, here's an AB on the left, here's an AB on the right.
Suppose you could compute all of this guy. So here's one way to think about it. Suppose you knew all these numbers, right? So you knew all that, you compute all these numbers somehow. So then you create this function out of those numbers. And I explained that, well, the ones which have the prime coefficients are just the ones you know. And the others you obtain by multiplicative property. So you create this infinite series. So, but a priori it's just some form of R6 which has no interesting properties, right? But it turns out that this is a Fourier expansion of a function on the upper half plane, which is modular, which has this properties, which is essentially invariant under this transformation. So that's remarkable. That's remarkable. But in fact, it's better to think in the opposite way, because it's much easier to find those guys than to compute those numbers, right? And because now we are in the realm of analysis. And analysis, how do we find functions? Maybe it satisfies some functional relations because it's invariant under this group. It also satisfies differential equations. So there are many, many different ways to pin down this function. And then once you have it, you have all of those numbers at once. So what kind of statement is it? I mean, what is the mechanism which allows you to connect number questions in number theory, or Diophantine equations of this type, to analysis? On upper half plane. Well, Langlands put this in this very broad context, and he explained that. I'm sorry? Tanya Yamashimura? Well, how much time do I have? 2 hours? So maybe I'll talk about it later.
They just satisfy the same functional equation.
There was all kinds of evidence, I suppose. But yeah, perhaps I shouldn't get too much into second guessing them right now. So anyway, what I want to say is that I want to emphasize that this looks like a freaky coincidence, but in fact it's not. It is actually part of a very broad and very mysterious connection between number theory and harmonic analysis, which is called the Langlands program. The link between number theory and harmonic analysis. So it's a very special case, in fact, of such a very general and very broad link, which was envisioned by Langlands. And in his letter that he wrote to Andrei Bey in 1967. And what he explained is that actually the way we want to think about this is that on the left-hand side, we look at what's called the Galois group. Galois group of Q over Q of Q bar over Q. Q stands for the field of rational numbers, all the fractions of integers, of relatively prime integers. Right? And algebraic closure means that we throw in all the roots of all polynomials in one variable that you could write with rational coefficients. This is a very large field which contains the field of rational numbers, and we can look at the group of automorphisms of this field. That's a Galois group. And what we want to do is we want to study representations of this Galois group. So n-dimensional. Not the same n. Dimensional representations. Of the Galois group. On one side, and Langlands' idea was that they should be linked to what's called automorphic representations. Automorphic representations of GLN, of the group GLN. So it's the same N as this one. N-dimensional representation of Galois group, automorphic representation of GLN. And that they should be linked, that there should be a link between the two. And the elliptic curve, this picture gives rise to a two-dimensional elliptic curve gives rise to a two-dimensional representation. This is not obvious, but it becomes somewhat obvious if you look at this picture. So this is an elliptic curve over the complex field, so it's a familiar Riemann surface. We know that it has two in equivalent cycles. this one, and this one. A cycle and the B cycle. So together they span what's called the first cohomology of this curve, or because everything is self-dual, in this case you can also think of it as the first cohomology of this curve, H1. So it's complex coefficients. Now we are talking about an elliptic curve defined over the rationals. But in that world there is its own cohomology theory, which you can construct, which is called the Tal cohomology. And it has, in many ways, properties which are very similar to the traditional topological cohomology that we talk about here. In particular, the first Tal cohomology of this elliptic curve is also two-dimensional. And because the curve is defined over the rationals, whatever symmetries you have of the algebraic closure are going to act on this vector space. So you get a natural representation of the Galois group on this two-dimensional space. What about those numbers? Those numbers of solutions could be recovered from this representation alone. So you don't need to look at the numbers of solutions of the equations. You can just look at this Galois representation. It captures all the information about the elliptic curves that we need. In particular, these numbers AP are contained in here. And on the other side, this modular form FE of tau is something which gives rise to an automorphic representation of GL2. Gives an automorphic representation of GL2. And this has to do with the fact that the upper half plane can itself be written as a quotient of SL2R by SL2, so that there is an action. There is an action of the group SL2R on the space of this function on the upper half plane. I'm not going to get into too much detail. But I hope it's clear that, roughly speaking, the elliptic curve of the Taniyama-Shimura Wey conjecture gives us an object on this side for n equal 2. And the modular forms gives us an object on the right-hand side, also for n equal 2. And the fact that there is a link between them is part of this very general principle, which is called the Langlands correspondence, or the Langlands problem. So this correspondence, the way I explain it here, it really hinges upon the group GLN. So this is an algebraic group. So what is GLN? GLN consists of all n by n matrices, yeah, which are invertible, so with non-zero determinant. So this is an example of what's called a reductive algebraic group. But then there are many other reductive algebraic groups, right? There is SLN, for example. There are orthogonal groups. There are symplectic groups, and there are those also weird groups. Which are called you know, E6, E7, E8, and G2, and F4, right? Simple algebraic groups. So whenever in mathematics, whenever you have some result which concerns GLN, which is in some ways the simplest reductive algebraic group, you always wonder what will happen if you replace GLN by a general reductive algebraic group, for example, orthogonal or symplectic. And a very remarkable thing happens if you do that here. In the formulation for GLN, you get n-dimensional representations of the Galois group. What is an l-dimensional representation? It's the same as a map to GLN. So you might expect that if you replace GLN on this side by some group G, like orthogonal or symplectic, you will have to replace here also by the same group. But in fact, you have to replace by a different group, and that's what is now known as the Langlands dual group. And that's exactly the group that appears also in S-duality, which was the first indication that the two subjects might and perhaps should somehow be connected. So now I move over to the physics side, and I talk a little bit about S-duality, the appearance of the Langlands dual group here, there, and then I will talk about how to connect the two. So LG is the Langlands dual group. And maybe I should give a couple of examples. If the original group is GLN, the dual group is also GLN. So you kind of don't detect it right away if you work in this context, the first approximation to the Langlands program that I wrote. But for instance, if you take SLN, it's already this dual is SLN divided by the cyclic group in the center. And perhaps more stunning duality is if you take an odd orthogonal group, then you're going to get a symplectic, and so on. So it's a very non-trivial operation on reductive algebraic groups, and the fact that this appears here is an indication that this can't be something simple. That this correspondence, this connection, must be profound, must follow from something very 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 sophisticated. So, can we see that happening in physics? So on the physics side, we start with a non-abelian generalization of the electromagnetic duality. So here we talk about this S-duality, which I have already mentioned. And so S-duality has to do with a four-dimensional supersymmetric gauge theory. In fact, we look at the maximally supersymmetric gauge theory in four dimensions, the one which is called N equal 4. So this theory is about the study of connections on a four manifold, let's call it M4, four-dimensional manifold. And we study bundles with connection on this four-dimensional manifold, which give us the gauge fields of the gauge theory. And then there are some additional fields, which are the super partners of these gauge fields. So there is a parameter then, there is a group, there's a compact Lie group this is a gauge group of the theory. And I'll be a little bit sloppy because in this discussion, my group was a complex Lie group like GLN. And now I will talk about compact Lie groups like SUN. But perhaps for the purpose of this seminar, the difference is not so essential. So I could put a little index C to indicate it's compact, but perhaps I shouldn't overload it with notation. So let's just say, let's use the same notation G for it. There's also one more parameter, which is a coupling, which is complexified coupling constant, tau, which combines the theta angle and the coupling constant of gauge theory. So you say in the case when G is U1, if we were working in a usual U1 gauge theory, not supersymmetric, usual U1 gauge theory with electrons, then E would be the electric charge. G would be E, the electric charge. This is a generalization of the electric charge in a general supersymmetric gauge theory. So I will assume here that it is a simple compact Lie group, so that we only have one coupling constant. And theta is a theta angle. So the statement of S-duality is the statement that two gauge theories associated to two different groups in general and two different coupling constants are equivalent to each other. And one of them is a group in which, is a theory in which the gauge group is G and the coupling constant is tau. And the other one is a gauge theory in which the group is a Langlands dual group, the same Langlands dual that shows up in the Langlands correspondence in here. It also shows up in here. And the coupling constant minus 1 divided by tau. Note, for example, that let's say the theta angle is 0, then tau is 4 pi I divided by g squared. So minus 1 over tau is essentially the transformation, tau goes to minus 1 over tau, is essentially the transformation which sends g to 1 over g. And that's perhaps the most remarkable aspect of this S-duality, because it links a weakly coupled theory for which the coupling constant is small, to a strongly coupled theory for which a coupling constant is very large. And which is, of course, a very strong, very important result, because it indicates that the non-perturbative nature of the four-dimensional gauge theory. As always, we usually write various quantities by path integral, which we then realize as a power series in the coupling constant. That power series converges at best when the coupling constant is very small. So then we have to know whether this is in fact a power series expansion of an analytic function. The existence of such, or a conjecture that such a correspondence exists, such an equivalence exists, suggests that in fact the theory does exist beyond perturbation theory. And moreover, you can obtain results about strongly coupled theory by simply looking at the theory at small values of the coupling constant. So it's a very strong, very important result, conjecture, really. In the abelian case, this can be proved by some manipulations, for example, with the path integral. So it's fairly well understood and accepted in the abelian theory. Abelian theory being somewhat decorated theory of quantum theory of Maxwell's electromagnetism. But in the non-abelian case, this is still a big mystery. And of course, one of the elements of it which make it so mysterious is the fact that the gauge group actually gets replaced by a different group. So why does the Langlands dual group appear in two different stories? One is the story of Galois representations and automorphic forms, which includes, as a special case, Tanyam-Shimura-Weil conjecture, therefore Fermat's last theorem. And the other one is the theory of S-duality in four-dimensional super-Young males. The answer was suggested only about 5 years ago, originally in a paper by Kapustin and Witten. And the idea was that we can go from this S-duality of four-dimensional theory, four-dimensional gauge theory, to a certain duality of two-dimensional, of closely related two-dimensional theories. Two-dimensional means real two-dimensional. So complex curves, for example, human surfaces would be a natural playground for such two-dimensional theories. And you can probably see already that the Langlands correspondence, the way it's defined, it kind of lives in the world of curves, in the world of Riemann surfaces, for example. And so it is not surprising that it will be closely linked to two-dimensional theory. But the idea is that the two-dimensional theory that one obtains, one gets it in the most natural way by looking at a four-dimensional N equal 4 super Young males. So that was the idea of Kapustin and Witten. Idea. They said, let's look at a special case where the four manifold on which our connections live, on which our theory lives, can be written as a product of two Riemann surfaces. So each of them is two-dimensional, so the product is four-dimensional as we want. And then let's assume that the size that sigma is much bigger than C, and take the limit when sort of sigma becomes infinitely big and C, then C remains small. So we get what's called an effective theory, quantum field theory, on sigma, which knows something about C. And this thing is going to be two-dimensional. Two-dimensional theory. So, in fact, earlier, about 10 years before this work, this two-dimensional theory was identified as the so-called sigma model. The sigma model. With the target manifold, the so-called Hitchin moduli space. So here I start with the gauge theory on the right. This one, gauge group G and parameter tau, and we do this dimensional reduction, we compactify on the surface C, we get a sigma model. Sigma model means that we are studying maps now from sigma to this moduli space. So what is this moduli space? This is a moduli space of what's called Higgs fields. This is where we have something in common, I guess, with a program on LHC, right? You guys are looking for the Higgs boson, and we are looking for Higgs bundles, so, you know. There is some similarity. In fact, of course, the reason why it's called Higgs bundle or Higgs field is because it comes, it's a shadow, it's a two-dimensional shadow of a scalar field in a four-dimensional gauge theory, so it's quite appropriate in some sense to call it a Higgs field or a Higgs bundle. But we'll see who finds theirs first. So MH of G describes pairs like this, where P is what's called the principal G bundle over C now. So we have a model in which our spacetime, the spacetime, is now sigma, the first factor of this decomposition. But the moduli space knows about C. And the way it knows about C is that C enters the definition. It's a moduli space of some objects on C. And these objects are, it's a principal G bundle. And phi is a section of the twist of the Lie algebra bundle, a tensor twist, the canonical Lie bundle. But the best thing is the name, right? So that's why it's called the Higgs field. So even if you don't know what this is, you kind of know what this is. So that's the target manifold for that theory. But this is the theory which you got from one of the two theories connected by S-duality, the one corresponding to G and tau. And what about the other one? The other one will give you MH of LG. Same thing, except now you replace the group G by its dual. And so the S-duality between the two gauge theories gives rise to a duality between the two theories. I just write it schematically like this. Maybe. Sigma 2 MH of LG. The two theories, whose two sigma models, two supersymmetric sigma models, maybe I should say it's a supersymmetric, n equal 2 supersymmetric sigma model, two sigma models whose target manifolds are these Hitchian moduli spaces associated to the two pair of Langlands dual groups. And in fact, this S-duality, it was argued even before Kapustin-Whitman, this S-duality between the two gauge theories gives rise to another beautiful duality in physics, which is called the mirror symmetry. But the decisive step in linking this picture to the Langlands correspondence was made by Kapustin-Whitman. And their idea was that if you have two quantum field theories, which are equivalent, then everything you can say about one of them should have an analog on the other side. Which, by the way, in electromagnetic duality, this is, of course, I talked about one aspect of it, which is the replacement of a coupling constant by its inverse. But another aspect is that sort of electric properties of particle fields and so on get replaced under this duality by magnetic properties. So, for instance, under this duality, a particle carrying electric charge, like electron, will get replaced by a particle which carries magnetic charge, like magnetic monopole. So, likewise, in this picture of two-dimensional theory, various objects on one side will get replaced by totally different objects on the other side. And what Kapustin-Whitman suggested is that we should look at what this mirror symmetry does to what's called B-brains. What does it do to B-brains? And of course, it's already done a lot to our brains, but in this case, and probably to your brains already, if you're here seeing things for the first time. Now, B brains are this can be thought of as these two-dimensional shadows of boundary conditions in the four-dimensional super Young mills. And they come in different flavors on two sides, because in fact, I didn't tell you one important aspect of this, which is that we are looking at what's called the topological field theory here. So we're looking, even though we do expect that test duality is correct for the full-fledged quantum field theory, but we are looking at kind of a simplified version of this theory, which is called topological field theory. And this topological field theory is, in addition, is twisted, which means that the action of the Lorentz group on various fields is distorted, so as to allow us to have a BRST charge, which we use to define the topological field theory. This is the reason why the scalar Higgs field gets replaced by one form. So, but the two twistings on two sides for things to work nicely actually have to be different. And one of the the twist on one side gives rise to what's called an A model, for those familiar with sigma models, and on this side what's called a B model. And actually, the brains, the boundary conditions, they have different flavor in the two models. The most important thing about brains, to know about brains, is that brains are objects of a category. So brains form categories. So you will have a category of brains on this side. Because it's an A model, it will be called the category of A brains. And there will be a category on this side as well. And because it's a B model, they will be called B brains. When I see your protein, I should just say brains. And because the two theories are equivalent, or we believe that they're equivalent under mirror symmetry, which is a trace of the S-duality, we do expect that these two categories are equivalent to each other. And so the idea of Kapustin-Witten was that this equivalence, in fact, this last equivalence, can also be put in the context of the categorical Langlands correspondence. In other words, to simplify slightly, this last equivalence of categories of brains is, in fact, the Langlands correspondence. So let's call this for equivalence. E is the Langlands correspondence, the geometric, categorical Langlands correspondence. So, well, it's probably better to say A category. Well, there are different flavors. It's a particular version of the categorical Langlands correspondence. So if you have survived up to now following, you might be wondering, what the hell do these things have to do with, Galois representations on this side and morph representations on that side, which is what I advertised as the main objects of the original Langlands correspondence. Well, there is a certain leap of faith. There is a certain analogy we have to make, because the point is that we are moving from the context in which the Langlands program was originally invented, which is number theory, to geometry. We are moving to geometry. And we are moving, in fact, to complex geometry. So it is very much like here on this side, studying, like I said at the very beginning, studying this equation mod P. And when we move to the world of complex geometry, we will get this. We will get the elliptic curve. We will study solutions over the complex field. So that's what we are doing, roughly. We are moving the Langlands correspondence, which has been so instrumental, for example, in getting Taniyama-Shimura-Weil conjecture and Fermat last year. And we are moving it to the realm of complex geometry, which roughly means that whenever you have some equation defined mod P, you are replacing it by the equation which is defined over the complex numbers. When you do that, the cast of characters has to change, because certain things which appeared before do not have any obvious analog in the geometric world. And so what happens, in fact, is that instead of a correspondence, instead of a connection between, say, Galois representations and modular forms, which I talked about earlier, the most natural and satisfying way to formulate the Langlands correspondence in the complex world is in terms of an equivalence of categories. So it becomes, the Langlands correspondence becomes, Langlands correspondence becomes an equivalence of categories. An equivalence of categories. Which categories would have to be for a dinner seminar or, I don't know, for a breakfast seminar? I will not. I'm not going to tell you, but I urge you to all to go to the webpage of our program, and there are many resources there. So you can, if you're interested, you can read more and find the wonderful videos of lectures that were. Our participants have given and are still giving here at this conference.
I have a question from this.
Yes?
What's a category?
What's a category? Okay. What a, this is very important. Yes, I maybe.
You know what the brain is.
A category is something which has. Which in which you keep track of symmetries of your objects. In other words, usually it's the next level of generality for after sets. So a set is a collection of objects, and that and there's no connection between them. And a category is something which has a collection of objects, but then you also have morphisms. For any two objects, you have morphisms between them. For instance, if you have objects and you can look at morphisms from the object to itself, and these are the inner symmetries of the object. So going to categories from sets is like enhancing your structure in that you are now starting to keep track of all the symmetries that your objects have. And one of the things that people have realized gradually in the geometric context is that in the geometric world, in the complex world, in fact, the most natural and satisfying formulation of this kind of result correspondences, like the Langlands correspondence, is inherently categorical. And at the same time, and perhaps in parallel, physicists have also realized that categories play an important role in quantum field theory. Because, I mean, first you study some functions, a correlation function. It's a vector in a vector space, maybe, it's an object, it's an element of a set. But then people realize that, in fact, in quantum field theory also naturally accommodates categories. Unfortunately, not only categories, but also two categories, three categories, and so on. But in particular, it does accommodate categories. And these categories show up, for example, through the study of brains. So the remarkable suggestion, idea of Kapustin-Witten was that this equivalence of the two categories coming from mirror symmetry is, in fact, which is a corollary of this S-duality, is, in fact, a version of the geometric Langlands correspondence. And so that gives us sort of a physics perspective on connection between, say, geometric analogs of the automorphic representations on this side, which are now we think of them as A brains, and the Galois representations on this side, which we think of as analogs of B brains. So, but then of course the big question is, where does S-duality itself come from? Because so far we have left it mysterious. And it turns out that actually physicists have an answer, or a sort of an answer. And the answer involves a mysterious six-dimensional theory. And I would love to tell you more about this, but I'm afraid this blackboard is too small. All this information. So there is this mysterious six-dimensional quantum field theory, superconformal field theory, of which we only know because it shows up in various ways in string theory and M theory. We know it's not Lagrangian, so we know bits and pieces about this theory. But it's this belief that this six-dimensional theory governs a lot of important phenomena, for example, in four-dimensional physics, in particular the S-duality.
Six-dimensional
theory. A six-dimensional theory, you can compactify down to four dimensions by using a two-dimensional piece. So writing your six-dimensional manifold as a product of Riemann surface and a four manifold. So in the first approximation, what you can do is And one of the examples you can consider is you can compactify on an elliptic curve. Elliptic curve with parameter, with modular parameter tau. So it is just going to be C divided by Z plus Z tau. Where tau is an element, is a point in the upper half plane. And so it is believed that this compactification gives us precisely the four-dimensional n equals 4 super Yang-Mills theory. I should say that it's not just one theory, but there is one theory of each of the ADE types. And so there will be a corresponding gauge group G, which corresponds to one of those types. And so now the mysterious S-duality becomes sort of a triviality, because we know that E tau is simply equal to E minus 1 over tau. And tau, this tau becomes the coupling constant, the complexified coupling constant. So from the point of view of the four-dimensional theory, this is a parameter, this is a coupling constant. But from the point of view of the six-dimensional theory, it is just a convenient way to write an elliptic curve. And the same elliptic curve will correspond to tau and negative 1 over tau. That's why the corresponding two compactifications have to be the same. This is in a simply laced case, ADE. But a slight generalization of this argument will also give you general S-duality. So this actually turned out to be the beginning of a very beautiful story, which is one of the main stories that we are exploring here at this program here at KITP. And the question is, so if S-duality and therefore Langlands program, Langlands correspondence, all come from compactifying this mysterious six-dimensional theory on an elliptic curve, what will happen if we compactify on a Riemann surface of a general genus? And it turns out that this way we actually obtain a large class of four-dimensional gauge theories, which will also exhibit a whole plethora of dualities very similar and vastly generalizing the S-duality. So we compactify on the general, maybe let's call it X, to be different from all other symbols I have used, general Riemann surface. And so this will be some four-dimensional theory. And this four-dimensional, between these four-dimensional theories, we have some new duality. One gets some new and interesting duality. And of course, one can ask, what is the analog of this in mathematics? So perhaps the mathematical Langlands duality should also be generalized to the case of general Riemann surfaces. So one note that I want to add is that I talked about the work of Kapust and Witten. This connection between the Langlands program and S-duality was a mystery for many years. And actually what helped to break this mystery was a meeting in February of 2004 at Princeton, at the Institute for Advanced Study, where a small group of physicists and mathematicians met and brainstormed. And at the end of the meeting, Edward Witten gave a talk and gave a broad outline of what the connection should be. It's something that I tried to explain to you very briefly in this lecture. And we were very fortunate that that meeting was supported by DARPA, by the Defense Advanced Research Projects Agency. And DARPA has been very instrumental, actually, in supporting research in this area for the last, 7 years. And in fact, we started a collaboration with KITP in 2008. We had the first meeting here. And I'm very grateful to David Gross for also supporting this. So we had our meetings here every year since 2008. This is our fourth meeting on bringing together physicists and mathematicians. And I'm also very pleased to have here today in the audience Tony Falcon, our manager at DARPA. So very grateful also to him and his predecessor, Ben Mann, at DARPA for supporting this effort, because I think that we've done pretty well and unraveled some of the mysteries. You know, I was able to give you some flavor, some ideas about the subject that we are studying. You know, Eugene Wigner wrote famously about unreasonable effectiveness of mathematics and natural sciences. And I think, you know, every day is bringing us new surprises. And I hope that we'll have the opportunity to continue discussing all of this here at KITP. Thank you very much.
Questions from outside the program.
Right. Could you give an example of flavor what these new 40 theories would be like? Okay.
these are going to be n equal 2 supersymmetric. Gauge theories. And in fact, in general, they're going to have a quite complicated group and quite complicated matter content. And both the gauge group and the matter content will correspond to a particular way of cutting a Riemann surface into pairs of pens. So what do I mean by this? So let's say you have a Riemann surface like this, right? So what you can do is you can cut. You need to cut it into the simplest possible pieces, right? So for example, you can cut here, and then what? Then you can cut here, and you can cut here, for example. In general, there are going to be many ways, right? So when you cut, you decompose your Riemann surface into these basic blocks, which are called pair of pens. Right? And so for each decomposition into pair of pens, you are supposed to have, when you compactify your theory on the Riemann surface, and you look at this Riemann surface, which is very close to the degenerate Riemann surface, where you are shrinking these cycles. So you are collapsing these cycles which you used to cut. And so this will be your coupling constants. The size, so to speak, the size of the circle is going to be hard. Correspond to the imaginary part of the corresponding coupling constant. So you already see that the gauge group will have as many factors, simple factors, as the number of cuts, right? So then next, you also are allowed to have some punctures. And those punctures will be responsible for the matter content. So there is some combinatorics which enables you to deduce the content of the theory from this kind of pure combinatorial data associated to the generation of the Riemann surface. But the most remarkable fact is that a Riemann surface has many different degenerations, right? So in fact, there is a whole moduli space of Riemann surfaces of a given genus with a given number of punctures, so it's called MGN bar. And so it is going to look something like this. So there is a big moduli space, and then there are some cusps. There are some points which correspond to degeneration. What I mean by degeneration is you collapse this like that. And you do the same here and here. So this collapsed curve will be one of the cusp points. And so the conjecture is that when you compactify the six-dimensional theory on a Riemann surface, which is very close to one of those degenerations, you are going to get this gauge theory with this coupling constant, with all this field content, which has some rule. But if you do it in a different corner, you will get a totally different description of that same theory. But the conjecture is that the theory exists everywhere. So it is a picture which is like M theory, which has different degenerations which you can describe by different types of string theory. Right? So here it's kind of on a smaller scale. You have a whole, the conjecture is that there is a whole family of four-dimensional supersymmetric gauge theories in four dimensions, which are parameterized by this moduli space and maybe some other data. And we have Lagrangian description in some of the corners. And in these corners, the coupling constants appear as just the more or less the radii of this circle, of this loops around which we degenerate. And so, in case of if our curve was an elliptic curve, it's kind of similar, because here you have these two cycles. You have this A cycle and you have the B cycle. And if you collapse one of them, it corresponds to tau goes to zero. If you collapse the other, it corresponds to tau goes to infinity. Right, and the fact is that the theory is the same, and so you're basically considering the same theory but at two different corners. So it is in that sense that considering a more general Riemann surface of genus G gives you a generalization of residuality, because now you actually have more corners, and the statement is that there is something in between which gives you, in the limit when you approach each of the corners, a particular a gauge theory with a particular Lagrangian description. Now it's time for those who are members of the group.
So I had a comment and a question. First, you said that we know the theory is non-Lagrangian. I think it would be more accurate to say we don't know if the theory is Lagrangian.
Really? I thought there were some arguments.
There are arguments, but they were similar arguments for the non-abelian M2 brains, okay, which were wrong. So all right. I would hesitate on that. Then I had a question, which is, suppose you take the practical, down-to-earth number theorist who works over Z.
Anyone?
Not here, maybe, but you know, the number theorist is just interested in you know, working,
yes,
in number theory with integers and so,
yes,
on. Has anything from this physical picture fed back and led to real advances in the original Langlands program over Z?
It's happening. It's trickling in, you know, slowly, because it's a long way, as I explained. But I'll give you an example. You know, for instance, I recently wrote a paper with Langlands and Goh in which we proposed a certain approach to proving what's called functional reality conjecture, Langlands functional reality conjecture, which is the cornerstone of the Langlands program in number theory. Right? And we proposed a certain way to tackle this by using what's called the trace formula. And this formalism that I'm talking about, this equivalence of categories of brains, for example, it gives a new perspective on trace formulas. David Benzie talked about some of this morning, and it gives us a way to geometrize trace formulas. And so eventually, the hope is that one can use geometry to prove these kind of things, which would then eventually feed back to the original questions in number theory. I have to say that.
So it hasn't happened yet, but it's very promising that something, some ideas from the physics will really translate back,
yes,
into
one of the
physical number theory.
That's right. So one of the important aspects of this duality between the A model and B model is this Hitchin vibration. In fact, both of these moduli spaces fiber over vector space, and these are two vibrations whose generic fibers are dual toroid, right? Right. So, but it's an important ingredient, and so in fact that has led, for example, us in our work to look at the analog of this Hitchin vibration in the context of trace formula. And for example, the fact that it's a vector space is something which people perhaps did not notice before is important, because we use, for example, Poisson summation formula on this analog of the Hitchin base to try to prove some of the results that we use for the functional reality. So the benefit could come in different ways. It could come because some of the results, people will see some new methods which would allow to tackle old problems. Or it could be that studying some objects on the geometric side might give people some inspiration, some ideas to introduce similar objects in a number theory context. But I do believe that eventually this will be very helpful for the development of the classical story.
Greg, if it allows me, so Harris and Taylor recently extended the modularity theorem to Calabi-Yau manifolds. They would never do it without some support from physics, or the ideas essentially from physics. But it's indirect, again, it is indirect. Some traces can be found in Gerasimov of straight attempts to extend it to arithmetic in Gerasimov papers, but this is not very much convincing so far. That's about it, I believe.
And the largest success in the classical Langlands program in the last several years, in Goh's proof of the fundamental lemma, uses ideas that directly fit into the picture that Edward described. I mean, his proof uses ideas from the geometry.
But did you get them
from physics, right? He got them from the geometric context, though. And so there's one step removed to get all the way from physics, because we understand the geometric context much better thanks to the physics.
But he would have done perfectly well without the physicists.
Absolutely. I agree with you.
Stop putting down the physics.
No, I have.